You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 11th of April, 2013, on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London with me, Phil Hahn and Sophie Grove.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll bring you the top stories you'll need to know in the next 24 hours. Our agenda setter today is Xenia Dormandy, Senior Fellow at Chatham House.
Tougher gun control has always proven to be one of the most difficult domestic issues for any US president. But can Barack Obama muster enough support to pass his bill?
We'll go through today's Brazilian papers with Monocle's resident Brazilian, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Fernando, what's caught your eye this morning?
We'll be talking about who is finally coming out in Brazil and how Chavez is being treated like a saint after his death. Yes, a proper saint.
We'll also speak to the Finnish author Mikko Koivumaa, who lives in Tokyo. He's been amazed by the love affair between the Japanese and the Finnish, so much so that he's written a book about it.
And in the preview of this week's Urbanist Show, we speak to an author who thinks that authenticity is a word we should be wary of.
When you think about authentic cities, you hit a blank right away, because the essence of cities is change.
All that, plus we'll play some music too, all to come here on the next hour on Midori House.
So a busy 60 minutes coming up here on Midori House, but first let's catch up with the latest news headlines with Barney Burnham.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. South Korea's defense ministry says North Korean missiles could be shot down if there's a risk of harm to people in the south. On Wednesday, South Korea said there was a very high probability that the North, after weeks threatening war, would test launch a medium-range missile at any time as a show of strength. Seoul says it's deployed Patriot Advanced Capability 2 anti-missile systems to counter any missile from the North if it appears to threaten its territory. The United States is warning that North Korea is close to a dangerous line. After reports that a North Korean missile had been fueled and prepared for launch, the U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel said the country must take a step back. Two U.S. senators say they've brokered a bipartisan deal to expand background checks on anyone buying a gun. It's tougher than current rules, which don't cover gun shows or online sales. News of the agreement came hours before a vote in the Senate on whether to allow a debate on gun control plans. Some Republicans have threatened to block the vote so the measure can't be debated. The First Lady, Michelle Obama, has joined the campaign for new gun control laws. Addressing a fundraiser in Chicago, she called for common sense reforms to protect children from gun violence. During her remarks, the First Lady often made reference to Hadia Pendleton, a 15-year-old girl who was killed at a Chicago park shortly after performing at President Obama's inauguration.
We can't stop all the violence in the world. But if there is even one thing we can do, even one step we can take to save another child or another parent from the grief that's visited families like Hadia's and so many others here today, then don't we have an obligation to try?
Thousands of people gathered outside the U.S. Capitol on Wednesday to rally for immigration reform as lawmakers and Senate negotiators were putting the finishing touches on a bipartisan bill. The bill being written in the Senate aims to wipe out nearly all illegal crossings along the southwestern border with Mexico while maintaining a 13-year timetable for existing illegal residents to win citizenship. New Jersey's Democratic Senator Bob Menendez told the rally outside that immigration reform would happen this year.
And to stand with my colleagues in the House of Representatives, in Congress, to say that we will make comprehensive immigration reform a reality this year, este año.
Thousands of demonstrators in Paris have taken to the streets to condemn a violent attack on a gay couple, as a divisive bill to allow same-sex marriage makes its way through France's upper house. Wilfried de Bruyne, a Dutchman who's lived in Paris for a decade, said he and his boyfriend were victims of a homophobic attack as they walked home from a party arm in arm. There's been a huge public response after he released a photo of his face taken after he was kicked unconscious by unknown assailants.
After some doubts, I thought, is this good taste? Is this a decent thing? Is it not exhibitionist? And then I said, no, it shows the face of what's happening in a society where gays are not tolerated and not accepted. And I'm glad I've done it, because I've seen it gives a picture, it gives a personal picture of a story that's lived by millions of people. And I think it's a good thing to speak of it and to show it.
Uruguay's Congress has passed a bill to allow same-sex marriages, making it the second country in predominantly Roman Catholic Latin America to do so. 71 of 92 lawmakers in the lower house of Congress voted in favour of the proposal 1 week after the Senate passed it by a wide majority. The leftist president, José Mujica, a former guerrilla fighter, is expected to sign the bill into law. Uruguay is the 12th country to pass a law of this kind, according to Human Rights Watch. In Latin America, Argentina has also approved gay marriage, and it's allowed in Mexico City and some parts of Brazil. Sir Paul McCartney has again topped Britain's Sunday Times rich list of musicians. The former Beatle has topped the list every year since 1989, when he was worth an estimated £80 million. This year, together with his American heiress wife, Nancy Chevelle, his fortune is put at £680 million, with £150 million coming from her. Sir Andrew Lloyd Webber came second on £620 million, with the Irish rock band U2 third on £520 million. The full list, which includes Victoria Beckham in the top 10, comes out on the 21st of this month. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, Barney. I guess one day we can only hope that we could make that list. Fingers crossed.
I'm not sure I'd want to be on a list with Victoria Beckham.
Thanks very much, Barney. Barney will be back in about 24 minutes with another check of the world news. Sophie, it's our debut show together. I'm very excited.
Very excited.
Should be a good one.
Hopefully.
Hopefully.
I'm sure it will be.
It is 16:06 in Tokyo, 8:06 in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24. London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24. London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
And welcome back. You're listening to Midori House live from Studio One here in London with me, Phil Hahn, and Sophie Grove. Well, now it's time to get ready and set the day's agenda. This is the part of the show where we ask our experts to choose the three big stories that we'll need to know in the next 24 hours.
Well, joining us now for today's agenda setter is Xenia Dormandy, Senior Fellow at Chatham House and regular contributor to Monocle 24. Thanks for joining us, Xenia.
Always a pleasure.
Shall we start with North Korea? Very much on the agenda all this week, but particularly today. We've had some saber rattling of sorts from Chuck Hagel. What's your sense of this story this morning, and how do you think it's developing?
Well, I mean, this is, if it weren't so serious, this would be daily entertainment. I mean, you know, every morning you wake up and there's another threat from North Korea. You know, that it looks like they're going to test a missile, possibly tomorrow, possibly even today, maybe Monday. They've done it before. This is no great news, except that it's a longer missile than they have previously used. This one could go up to, I think it's about 4,000 kilometers. That could reach Guam, which from an American perspective matters, but I mean, clearly can reach all of Japan, South Korea. You know, this is saber rattling extraordinaire. And then, as you said, Chuck Hagel kind of made a statement yesterday and said, you know, be very, very careful. You're awfully close to the line. Not clear that that's going to have any impact on North Korea at all. Meanwhile, the North Koreans, of course, are saying, telling all of the embassies to evacuate, telling tourists to leave South Korea, where I'm going in 2 weeks. I haven't cancelled my trip. And the State Department is saying, don't worry. And the other embassies are saying, don't worry. So, we'll see.
And we are waiting for this missile launch to happen any day now. The Americans have already said that when they do launch that, they will shoot it down if it does get close to their bases in Guam or that part of the world. If that does happen and this missile does get shot down, what's the reaction then from the North Koreans?
Well, I think there's two parts. There's a group in the United States who are saying the missile goes up, it should get shot down regardless of where it goes. There are even some in Japan who are saying it goes anywhere near us, we take it out. North Korea has in the past shot missiles over Japan. And then there's the others who say, as long as it doesn't go anywhere near our space, you know, you get to test. There's two scenarios. And there's, of course, the scenario that it fails, which is quite conceivable. If the US, the Japanese, the South Koreans, somebody else does actually attempt to shoot it down and succeeds, that's a significant step up in kind of what the North Koreans would perceive to be offensive, and makes it, therefore, that much harder to walk down. I mean, I don't think anybody... There's a danger of calling the North Koreans irrational or rational. They're clearly rational actors, but they maybe have a different kind of set of equations of the way they think about things. It's hard to believe that such an action would not significantly step up tensions in North Korea. How they would then come back down in a face-saving way is hard to imagine. So it really does take a significant step if we were to do that.
Zenya, let's move on and talk about another story today. Afghanistan and Pakistan, there's some very interesting negotiations going on, especially regarding the Taliban, and the fighting season's really just started, a bit of an ugly start in many ways. How do you think some of these tensions are really going to play out over the next couple of days?
You're right. It's an interesting... I mean, what I find so interesting... Currently, really in the last week or so about Afghanistan and Pakistan, you continue to hear the news today. In the news, there was another shooting of a policeman who was protecting polio workers. Yesterday, the news was about the Taliban emissaries who are sitting in Qatar and have been sitting in Qatar for about a year now, doing very little because negotiations aren't going on. And negotiations aren't going on because there's tension between the Pakistanis and the Afghans and the Taliban and the Americans. And nobody really wants, everybody wants to talk to some of those groups, but not other groups. So they're sitting there doing very, very little. And underneath all of this that we're reading in the newspapers, I've been talking to a couple of people who have just come back from Afghanistan who are saying, actually, it's really not so bad. Now, you know, the message, the narrative that we get in the papers is a frightening one, is a scary one. Everybody's talking about the withdrawal in 2014 and the elections before that and what's going to happen and is the country going to collapse? Is the country going to spiral into violence? But a lot of people say on the ground that actually, you know, life goes on, it's ticking forward. We shouldn't have this kind of level of stress that we do, and yet we get these daily stories.
So what is the Taliban game plan then going forward? Is it to try and negotiate something, or is it to wait until this withdrawal and then really make their push to regain control?
Again, I mean, you have to... the answer is we don't know. If we knew what the Taliban were going to do, then we'd be, you know, at least one step, if not a couple of steps ahead of where we are today. But again, you have to actually look at them as rational actors. And as rational actors, if you're the Taliban, there's a strong argument to say, you know what, I know everybody's pulling out in 2014. The ground's mine. Don't negotiate anything that we can't then reverse. There's no great incentive to not just wait it out. And so there's every indication that that's what's going on. You know, as I said, the Taliban emissaries in Qatar have been sitting there for about a year doing very, very little. It's complicated by the fact that, of course, that President Karzai wants to make sure that he's the one negotiating with the Taliban, but the Taliban don't want to negotiate with Karzai because they think he's an illegitimate government. They want to negotiate with the Americans, but the Americans don't want to irritate Karzai. The Pakistanis want in because they've long been friends of the Afghan Taliban, at least, or supported the Afghan Taliban. So you've got this wonderful. You just need to lock them in a room for a couple of days, perhaps.
I love that. Very, very complex politics there, described very well. Just finally, I know you're coming back to talk about some US politics a little bit later, but Obama is setting out his budget to Congress. Tell us a little bit about that.
So this is really interesting for those who watch America domestically, and it really matters internationally as well as domestically. So we shouldn't. Limit it to just that. But Obama put forward his budget to Congress yesterday, 2 months late, arguably 2 months late, he said, because of the fiscal cliff and the debates around that and the sequestration. But we now have three budgets floating around Congress. We have the Senate budget, we have the House budget, and we have the President's budget. Where this goes, how this goes forward, we don't really know. What is really interesting about Obama's budget and is incredibly controversial is he's actually antagonized both the Republicans and the Democrats. So on the Republican side, he's asking for more taxes, and the Republicans are saying, we've done everything we can, we've done everything we're going to do. And on the Democratic side, he's said, you know what, we really do actually need to make cuts to Social Security, to healthcare, to entitlements. And we need to figure out how we're going to do that. And so he's actually... he's kind of, in some respects, returned to a kind of more Clintonian type of Democratic politics, which says, you know what, we can't get all we want. We actually have to come back into the middle and see both sides. So it's interesting. Whether it works or not is a different matter
but
entirely.
His budget is essentially dead on arrival, isn't it? No one's really looking at it with any real possibility of going forward.
You say that, but the final result is most likely to be somewhere close to Obama's budget, because, of course, the Senate, which is led by the Democrats, bought out a budget that was, you know, very strong on the Democratic side, but antithesis to the Republicans, and the Congress the House did the opposite. So actually, Obama's budget is somewhere in the middle, and that's most likely some form of that is what we're going to see.
Well, Zenia, thank you. That was Zenia Dormandy setting the agenda with the three big stories we need to know today.
And Zenia, we will ask you to stay in studio for our next discussion, which I'm sure will be a very heated and interesting one as well. We'll be talking gun control legislation in the U.S.
Grasse is legendary when it comes to the alchemy of perfume making. Monocle's film crew travel to the south of France to discover a new generation inheriting these traditions and making them their own.
My first souvenirs, we were working with flowers with my sister, trying to create and invent and, of course, sell some perfumes from our own. So, yes, it was in our DNA. But perfume is a wonderful world, and we're very lucky to have that in the family.
Making Sense, in the film's menu on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House. It is a 15:17 in Singapore, 10:17 in Istanbul, and 8:17 here in London. Now, when 20 young school children and 6 adults were killed at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut, President Obama and much of the country pledged to never let a horrific incident like that happen again. While making stricter gun control a key priority for his second term, Obama has been busy spreading his message across the country and imploring Americans to bring the bill to a vote.
Well, it looks like his campaign may be paying off, at least partially. Late on Wednesday night, a deal was struck by a group of bipartisan senators on a range of gun control issues, including stricter background checks and tighter trafficking laws. The Senate looks set to start debate on the bill today, but has a long road ahead. Joining us in the studio is Zenia Dormandy, again, Senior Fellow of Chatham House, and Jeffrey Kaufman, London correspondent for ABC News. Welcome to the studio, Jeffrey.
Good morning.
So maybe you could start just by setting the scene. You know, there have been a lot of discussions about this, and we just heard Michelle Obama, a very passionate plea almost. What do you think is really going to happen in the Senate today?
Well, I think what's so interesting is that, you know, we have seen this film before. Something horrific happens. A mass shooting happens in the U.S. Hearts are, the world, America is devastated. And there are pledges, sincere pledges, that we shall reform the access to guns in the U.S. And this happens over and over, and nothing changes. And it looked like that's where we were happening yet again after the horrific shooting of killing of 20 children in Newton, Connecticut, before Christmas. This time, though, perhaps this week we've seen a change. And I really think this is a big deal. Because simply to move the needle a little bit on gun control in the U.S. is a huge accomplishment. The National Rifle Association, the NRA, is one of the most powerful lobby groups in America, and it has created a fear amongst elected politicians through its rankings and through its lobbying that if you defy us, we will do everything to defeat you. And for decades, they really have reigned supreme, and that's why we see the U.S. has more than 300 million guns, one gun per person, more than 10 million guns sold per year. The numbers are staggering. you could outfit every NATO troop with 5 guns, just with the number of guns sold in the U.S. each year. What's happened is this. Two rookie senators, one a very conservative Democrat, Joe Manchin, from West Virginia, and the other a very conservative Republican from nearby Pennsylvania, Pat Toomey, got together, both gun owners, both with A ratings from the National Rifle Association, and they said, let's see if we can come up with something. And essentially what they're doing is plugging the biggest loophole which gives access to guns, the so-called gun show loophole. 2 out of 5 guns are sold this way. And if you buy a gun at a shop, you have to have a background check through the FBI. If you buy a gun at a gun show, you don't. And so, of course, if you have criminal intent, you just go to a gun show, buy a gun, and off you go. 70% of crimes are committed with guns bought at gun shows. Now they're moving to plug it.
And Zenya, we heard Jeffrey there talking about the power of the NRA. Those two senators, the Republican and the Democrat, both A ratings by the NRA. I think the NRA donated some $1.5 million to Toomey's campaign. What changed then with these two senators? What made them drastically, you know, move away from the NRA, which has been such a strong supporter of those two senators?
Well, what's interesting is you know, throughout this debate since late December when the attack at Sandy Hook Elementary School occurred, even the NRA has said, you know, there could be ways forward, there could be small steps. Now, it's hard to imagine, well, one can question how sincere they were about that, but essentially, you know, as Jeff said, I mean, they're plugging small loopholes. There are all sorts of things. You know, Obama was trying to get a new bill forward about the type of ammunition or the size of a cartridge that you could carry on a gun or that you could sell.
Assault rifles, high capacity magazines.
That's the word. Assault rifles, exactly. And that isn't happening. And so the question really is, you know, is there a moment today? And you're actually seeing this, I mean, interestingly enough, you're seeing this in a whole set of kind of domestic issues that are incredibly politically relevant, whether it's, you know, gay marriage, whether it's immigration, and all of these are now kind of appear to be hitting a tipping point, both in the general public, but also in Washington, of saying maybe we need to make some small movement forward. And I think gun control is kind of coming in. It's the elections in November and the results of that. It's the events at Sandy Hook Elementary School all coming together to create a certain amount of momentum that says we're not going to get everything we want done. But actually, as Jeff says, small steps in a positive direction is perhaps all that can be done, and we should grasp that.
And I'm not sure, in fairness, that this is a small step. This is a pretty big step. Mm-hmm. The advocates of gun control have said that the biggest single problem is this so-called gun show loophole, which allows 2 out of 5 guns to be bought without any background check. And plugging that is huge. Now there are still loopholes, and we can go into it, but I want to make 2 broader points. One is the politics of this. It's really interesting how this is happening. This is not, although Obama has very much pushed the agenda on gun control, this is not Obama at work, at least not outwardly.
But this he has staked a lot of political capital.
He has, but this is how politics works in any country, but particularly in the U.S. Two conservative senators, one Republican, one Democrat, separate from the White House and from liberal gun control advocates, have pushed this. And that's what it takes. You have to come from the far right in order to push this through. It's fascinating. They, in fact, said to Chuck Schumer, the gun control senator from New York, don't come to the news conference yesterday. They didn't want him present. This is so toxic. It's so fragile. And there is so much pressure from the NRA to filibuster this, to kill it through procedure, that the calculus is as important as the content. The second point I would make is this, that Mike Bloomberg, the billionaire mayor of New York, who has now become the most outspoken advocate of gun control after the president, is putting a lot of money into an anti-NRA and is now supporting candidates who push for gun control, and has actually now just this week come out with a rating system, the NRA giving its A for its supporters. He's coming out with a counter rating system. There is. I think Zenya's right. There's a tipping point here, and it's very interesting. But I think that the politics of gun control seem to be shifting more than a little in front of our eyes.
Can I just pick up on your first point very, very briefly? It's almost gun above politics, which is to say, you know, as you say, Schumer, the president, they've both said this is more important than my name being on it. And so I'm actually willing to step back, not take credit for it, to make this happen, which is fascinating.
Yeah, and I think that the NRA needs to worry because they've really held this without movement for a long time, and now seeing this much movement, it opens the possibility of more in the future.
Well, Jeffrey Kaufman, London correspondent for ABC News, and Zenya Dormandy, senior fellow at Chatham House, thank you both for joining us very much.
We could talk about this forever, I think. A very interesting topic indeed. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for that discussion. But up next, we'll discuss the Japanese love affair with the Finns.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monaco 24.
Oi, London. This is Monaco 24.
Ot London, tu vai Monaco 24.
Fra London, dette Monaco 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Holanda.
London, Europe,
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monaco 24.
Now, there is a fascinating love story taking place between Finland and Japan. Tokyo is steadily climbing on the list of the most successful holiday destination for Finns, but it's nothing compared to what's going on in Japan.
The Japanese have taken such a liking to the Nordic countries, and Finland in particular, that they are now nowadays one of the most visible tourist groups in Helsinki. During the past few years, Finnish bands sometimes had their biggest success in Japan. However, nowadays, music is not the major export. Instead, Moomins, Santa Claus, the Finnish education, Angry Birds, they all have turned into major successes in Asia.
Someone who knows about this love story is Mikko Koivumaa, who lives in Tokyo and works there as a counsellor for press and culture at the Finnish embassy. Mikko has also written a book for the Japanese market, where he compares the ways children are actually raised in both countries. Roughly translated, the name of the book is Ikumen Mikko's Happy Finnish Childcaring. Mikko joins us now from our Tokyo bureau. Thank you for joining us on Midori House, Mikko.
Thank you for having me.
Now, let's start with this love affair, as we've described it. What do you think makes Finland so appealing to the Japanese?
Well, firstly, all Nordic countries are rather popular here in Japan, but for some reason, which is it's kind of hard to explain, it seems that Finns just might be the most popular among Japanese. And Finnish culture.
So what is it about the Finns then that the Japanese just love so much?
Well, there are certain things that we can easily understand. There's the Moomins, which are extremely popular here in Japan and have been for 3-4 decades. So if Moomin, it's a Finnish animation and which arrived at Japan very early on. And then we have Santa Claus and we have Aurora Borealis, which is a major reason why so many Japanese people travel to Finland. And then more later, Scandinavian design and Finnish design as part of it, and the whole Nordic and Finnish lifestyle has become very popular among Japanese young people.
And Mikko, I have to say, when I was recently in the northern part of Finland, in Lapland, I did actually see just busloads and plane loads of Japanese people. But I wondered whether or not you think there is any similarity between the two cultures. I mean, you live in Japan and you've obviously written a book about child caring. I wondered if there's anything that they share as a culture.
Oh, I believe as Europeans, perhaps Finns are closest to Japanese. So inside Europe, so we are rather silent, quiet people and very modest people, just like Japanese, and in a way stoic in our perception of things. And we have some cultural things like for the love of sauna or hot springs and love for nature is, we have many similarities which I think some others might not have.
I am a fan of saunas as well.
Me too. Can I ask you, but really critically about your book, because it's very interesting to compare child-rearing cultures. What do you think that the Finnish way of bringing up children could add to Japanese culture? And how does it differ from the way that Japanese children are raised?
Well, my book concentrates on the role of the men. So currently, since 1-2 decades ago, men have had a bigger role in child rearing, and Japan is not there yet, but there's more and more people, young mothers and fathers, who have a bigger interest in having a bigger role for the fathers, whereas traditionally in Japan it's solely a burden for the mothers. So there's many differences, much more than similarities in child rearing, I would say.
And you talk about this love affair between the Japanese and Finland. Does that hold true with other countries in Asia? Do they find this fascination as well, this connection with other Nordic countries?
Well, what comes to other Asian nations and Finland or other Nordic countries, I think Japan is very special. I think they know much more about Nordic countries and especially Finland. They know much more than Chinese people, average Chinese people, for example. So that's what makes the difference. And what they know is usually very positive things. So the things that you mentioned in the beginning. So it's mostly always positive things. So we're very fortunate in that sense.
Do you think that the Japanese want to learn more from the Finnish way of child rearing?
I think so. I think, we enjoy this general interest by the Japanese, and I think this is a new story. And Finnish education is already very well known here in Japan for the past 10 years now. And our welfare state is very well known. So I think this child rearing, it's kind of a new part of that bigger story.
And do you get questioned? I mean, do people ask you, well, tell me about, your role as a father. What can I learn from you?
Yes, we get that kind of inquiries very often. I've been talking about it last 2 years quite a lot.
Thanks very much. That was Mikko Koivumin in Tokyo. Thanks for joining us here on Midori House.
Interesting words of wisdom from Mikko there. In the next half hour of the programme, we'll get a view on why authenticity is a dangerous word when talking about cities.
When you think about authentic cities, you hit a blank right away, because the essence of cities is change.
But first, here's Barney Burnham with the news headlines.
Thanks, Sophie. South Korea's defense ministry says North Korean missiles could be shot down if there's a risk of harm to people in the south. On Wednesday, Seoul said there was a very high probability that the north, after weeks threatening war, would test launch a medium-range missile at any time as a show of strength. Two US senators say they've brokered a bipartisan deal to expand background checks on anyone buying a gun. News of the agreement came hours before a vote in the Senate on whether to allow a debate on gun control plans. The First Lady Michelle Obama has joined the campaign for new gun control laws. Speaking in Chicago, she called for common sense reforms to protect children from gun violence. Thousands of people gathered outside the US Capitol on Wednesday to rally for immigration reform, as lawmakers and Senate negotiators were putting the finishing touches on a bipartisan bill. Thousands of demonstrators in Paris have taken to the streets to condemn a violent attack on a gay couple, as a divisive bill to allow same-sex marriage makes its way through France's upper house. Meanwhile, Uruguay's Congress has passed a bill to allow same-sex marriages, making it the second country in predominantly Roman Catholic Latin America to do so. Sir Paul McCartney has topped Britain's Sunday Times rich list of musicians for the 25th year running. When he first topped the list in 1989, he was worth an estimated £80 million. This year, together with his American heiress wife, Nancy Chevelle, his fortune is put at £680 million, with £150 million coming from her. Those are the headlines, the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Sophie Grove, and Phil Hahn.
This week, The Urbanist is looking at language, from the words we see on signs, to the slogans luring in tourists, to the buzzwords used by the experts to explain city development. Well, in this preview, we sit down with Sharon Zukin to discuss one of the seemingly academic terms that sits at the center of one of urbanism's most impassioned debates, authenticity. Zukin's the author of Naked City, The Death and Life of Authentic Urban Places. It's a subtitle is a play on the celebrated urbanist Jane Jacobs' 1961 manifesto.
So what happened to Jacobs' ideals, her authentic urban environments? Zukin argues that all authenticity is contrived. All those cute organic food stores, old loft buildings and chic ethnic restaurants come at a price for the working class, ordinary people who gave the neighbourhood its so-called authenticity in the first place. Monocle's Barrett Austin met with Zukin in New York to talk about why authenticity is a word we should all be wary of.
The basis of authenticity is being real or being true. But the very concept in general has two sides that are quite different. On the one hand, authenticity refers to something, a cultural form, a set of social practices that are really, really old, practically primordial. And in that sense, those cultural forms are invented over a very long period of time by a group of people. On the other hand, we use authenticity to mean something that is radically new, dramatically innovative. And in that sense, we often identify authentic things and authentic people with individuals, the creative genius, the person who flies against the group or who flies against mainstream culture. When you think about authentic cities, you hit a blank right away because the essence of cities is change. Cities start by agglomerating all kinds of people and functions and things and products. You have a dense mass of difference. So cities are difference, cities are change. It's the very diversity of cities that is authentic, and that's the quality that cities around the world risk losing.
I'm going to talk a little bit about the way that developers consider the term authenticity. It seems that in the year 2013, perhaps more than ever, there's a real appreciation in cities like New York for that which is authentic. How would a developer see the word authenticity and perhaps its value in developing something in a city like New York?
Developers see the value of authenticity because it has become a marketing paradigm. In the 1990s and early 2000s, a couple of guys associated with Harvard Business School, marketing gurus, started to write about the so-called experience economy. They said that modern societies, like the American, has moved beyond manufacturing and beyond services to a substantial trade in experiences. And if retail stores and other kinds of purveyors of services and consumer goods want to stay in business, they have to start trading in the intangibles of their business. So a developer would apply this to a new building by saying, we are in a historic district. There are all these great restaurants and art galleries and other opportunities for cultural consumption. This is the authentic city that we are bringing to you in luxury apartments. You know, the kinds of places that we live in and frequent are different kinds of places. We've become much more dependent on restaurants and stores than on old-style neighborhoods in the old sense. And yet we constantly have a building of new kinds of authenticity. It just looks a lot more effete than the old authenticity, and it's not as gritty.
What concrete examples can you give, either in the U.S. or abroad, as cities that you would describe as being very authentic? And are there any examples of a city that's perhaps not authentic? Is there such thing as a city that's not authentic?
No. I don't think we can describe a whole city as authentic. And in fact, I'm not even sure that I would want to describe any part of a city, any neighborhood or district as authentic. To describe something as authentic is to take a position from outside of it. And we have to realize that it's kind of a cultural criticism, even to talk about authenticity. When you're living in an authentic experience, you don't step outside of it to say, hey, this is really an authentic experience. So we can't talk about a whole city as being authentic. And in fact, with so much place marketing of neighborhoods and of cities for tourism and for outside investment, authenticity becomes just a marketing model. So it's really, really hard to say what is authentic, and I would not want to give the kiss of death to any neighborhood to say that it is authentic. What I'd like to see is the jagged edges where you don't have a homogenization into all new development or into all rich people's neighborhoods, where you have different kinds of people living in the same place in relatively healthy conditions in all cities of the world, from Shanghai to New York, from Amsterdam to Bangkok. The capital to be made in cities is really driving out the poor and driving out innovation for everybody.
And that was author Sharon Zukin there with Monocle's Barrett Austin for this week's edition of The Urbanist, which you can catch at 1900 London time today, right here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House. Be back right after this with a check-in with our woman in Mali.
The Monocle app puts Monocle 24's pacey mix of current affairs, business, culture and music in your pocket. Whether it's midnight in Marunouchi or sunrise in Sydney, tune in to our around-the-clock audio service live from Midori House. Or download and replay your favourite programmes using the time shift feature. Also at your fingertips, our complete global travel guide. Get all this and more on the go on the Monocle app.
You're listening to Midori House. The time is 15:42 in Hong Kong and 8:42 here in London.
Joining us now on the line from the Malian capital of Bamako is Monocle's woman there, Alex Duval-Smith. Alex, thanks for joining us here on Midori House. We heard earlier this week that French troops began their initial pullout from the country there. But one thing that a lot of people aren't talking about is the welfare of the prisoners that those French troops have captured.
Yes, indeed. As you rightly mentioned, about 100 of the 4,000 French troops have been sent back to France now, having begun their intervention here in January. Pretty symbolic, actually, pullout, but it's one that the French intend to sort of scale up over the year to eventually have about 1,000 troops here. And quite interestingly enough, here, this is a war in which we haven't heard very much about the prisoners until now. The International Committee for the Red Cross yesterday signed an agreement with the government of Mali. What's been happening is that all the prisoners that have been caught, or caught is the wrong word, but that have been captured and handed over to the Malian authorities by the French and by the Chadians, who've been those doing most of the fighting. And so they're now in Malian jails. Mali has the death penalty. Mali has quite routine use of torture. So the French authorities have got the Malians to insist that none of their captured prisoners will be tortured or subject to the death penalty. There are about 300 prisoners in total, not all of them captured by the French, some of them captured by the Malians and Chadians. And now the International Committee for the Red Cross is going to have visiting rights, the ability to interview them in private, the ability to have conversations with the government about the conditions in which they're being held. So the ICRC isn't telling us very much about the conditions, but they're very pleased to have this agreement because it means that there's a sort of dialogue that's opened with the government.
And Alex, it looks like quite a few of them are international prisoners. We're looking at Algerians, some Moroccans, but also two French jihadists that have actually been expelled to France. I wonder how the complexity of these different nationalities will play out.
Well, what's quite interesting is that, the, as you say, two of them have been expelled to France. That happened in the last sort of 8 weeks or so. And they were also quite young, half French, half Malian, or half Burkinabe in one case, suspected jihadists. The others are Algerian, Moroccan, Mauritanian, four Nigerian, who are suspected members of Boko Haram. And those countries have not asked for the extradition of their nationals. So those remaining foreign nationals will be tried in Mali. And what's going to be interesting to see is how they're treated. Mali doesn't really have anti-terrorist legislation. So the European Union has just announced some money to train magistrates and to try and to bring the law up to speed with the requirements, in fact, of this conflict. So they will be tried here.
And Alex, you're there in Bamako, currently under a state of emergency since a coup in March last year. But tomorrow actually marks the anniversary of the longest state of emergency in Africa, in Swaziland. How's that being marked?
Yes, well, no, it's quite, I just spotted that by chance. The 12th of April, 1973, King Sobhuza II of Swaziland declared a state of emergency. Now, you know, we're quite accustomed to talking of the Swazi monarch as being Africa's last absolute monarch. Well, that's what makes him absolute. This was his grandfather, actually, the present king's grandfather, who declared the state of emergency. And there are going to be some demonstrations in South Africa today by trade unionists, and one also at the border, and a debate in the capital of Swaziland, in Durban, because, of course, demonstrations are banned there. So all you can do is talk about it.
Alex, I wanted to ask you about another story in Kenya. Long-awaited announcement about a low-cost airline in the country.
Yes, that's Jambo Jet, which is going to be launched by Kenya Airways. We've been waiting for this announcement for a long time. It finally came yesterday in an interview between the CEO of Kenya Airways, Titus Naikuni, and Bloomberg. He says it's going to be launched during this coming year. It's a long-awaited announcement because Jambo Jet is seen as really the only venture that can compete with Fastjet, which I think on Monocle we've been giving quite a lot of coverage to. Fastjet is Stelios Hagiana's venture based out of East Africa, he being the EasyJet founder, of course. So Fastjet was launched last year in Tanzania without really having a competitor, and with still the sort of debate underway as to whether Africa really is ready for budget airlines, whether the African middle class is really big enough to sustain the kind of price competition that's required for you to really be able to talk of budget airlines rather than just airlines that do, you know, occasionally very cheap flights. But anyway, good news for the airline passenger in Africa, because Jambo Jet is set, if Kenya Airways is to be believed, to offer some competition to Fastjet.
Alex, I wanted to ask you finally about the French president's camel, donated by the Malian government as a real token of thanks. But it seems like it's met a rather difficult end.
Well, it did, yes. This happened in February. President François Hollande came over for a visit, was greeted in Timbuktu as a great hero for, of course, liberating the country from the jihadists, and as custom would have it, was handed quite a small camel, which he decided to leave with a Timbuktu family, who promptly made it into a tagine, into a local stew. It probably, when it was made into a local stew, I'm sorry to sound a bit cruel, but the French government was probably greatly relieved. The problem is that the government of Mali got wind of the fact that the camel had been turned into a stew, and so they've now found another camel to give to President Hollande to replace the first one, and now they've got to get that one back to France, which of course involves vaccinations, freighting at huge costs, and then what do you do with it when you get to France? President Hollande joked that he was going to sort of negotiate Parisian traffic jams on his camel, but of course we all understand that was a joke.
Well, Alex, as ever, lovely to speak to you from Bamako. That was Monocle's woman in Mali, Alex Duval Smith.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
Could you imagine Francois Hollande there at the presidential palace with a camel in the backyard?
No, no, it's ridiculous. But I can imagine him tucking into a camel tagine.
Camel tagine, yeah, sounds delicious. Well, we're going to have a check of the day's Brazilian papers, but before that, it's time for a little bit of Brazilian music. This is Silva with Falando Sério. And that was the beautiful sounds there of Silva with Falando Sério, a personal favorite, I think, of our next guest, Fernando.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Sophie Grove and Phil Hahn. And yes, that was almost just a kind of musical introduction for you, Fernando.
I love this song.
You can see it tapping. You almost danced into the studio.
How do you pronounce it just before we start?
It's his name is Silva and the song is Falando Sério, talking seriously.
Right, Fernando, we're going to have a look at some Brazilian papers. You prepared some interesting stories. Let's start with Folha de São Paulo, it's Chavez is making the front pages this
Absolutely.
Morning.
Absolutely.
And it's a very interesting piece about a revolution museum in Caracas, a sort of mausoleum slash museum, it should be said.
It's an interesting angle because, you know, the presidential elections are on the weekend, on Sunday. But then Folha de São Paulo did a nice feature about this recently built Revolution Museum. And actually, they interviewed one of the guides of the museum. And actually, she said basically the place is very, how can I say that, energetic. She said that the Supreme Commander is sending us some energy. So that's quite an interesting thing, because in Latin America, we have something what I would call religious syncretism, which we mix religion with everything, basically. You know, the candidate of Chavez, Nicolas Maduro, he saw a dove recently, and then he said that the dove actually was Chavez. I mean, that's quite sweet somehow, you know. But there's this new museum, and I do believe that Maduro is still the favorite to win the election.
And a lot of people, when Chavez died, were contemplating whether or not he was going to be embalmed. So if he was, he would have been perhaps at this Revolution Museum, I guess.
Exactly.
Do you think it's going to be
he's sending a lot of energy to all of us.
Do you think it'll be a hot kind of tourist attraction there in Caracas?
I think so. I think even if you're not a big fan of Chavez, come on, he represented Venezuela so well. He's such an iconic figure. If I go to Caracas, I would like to visit the Revolution Museum.
I mean, it's an interesting this syncretism you're talking about, that you know, someone might be embalmed at the same time, but it might become also a political landmark and something of a shrine in many ways. That it sort of progresses from being, you know, a grave or a mausoleum into something else, because there's so much around this man and in his legacy.
Exactly. I mean, and that's what I say. I think he's been treated not only as a politician, as an iconic figure, but as a saint somehow. You know,
that's. And moving on to O Globo, you have a story here about gay rights in Brazil.
Exactly. There's quite a lot of going on gay rights in Brazil. Basically, I mean, there was we had a president of our Human Rights Commission. He was recently appointed. His name is Feliciano. And the thing is, he's, how can I say that? He's a racist and a homophobe. Yeah.
I mean, don't mince your words, Fernando.
Yeah, maybe I'm too kind, but it's true. And he said he gave terrible declarations and everything, but there's been quite a lot of protest against him. And that's a good sign in Brazilian society. I think people are turning against those kind of people. And on an interesting note, we have a singer called Joelma. She sings a calypso, which is some sort of Brazilian pop rhythm. And she said recently on the press, comparing gays to drug users. And there's been a huge backlash on that. And one of our most famous singers, Daniela Mercury, that's quite a good note. She's one of the most high-profile people in Brazil who came out. So she said, I'm a lesbian, I'm living with my wife, and very happily. So that's quite an interesting thing, Brazil. I think it's positive news on gay rights. And continuing on Latin America, still on Globo, they're mentioning that the Uruguayan Congress, they voted to legalize gay marriage yesterday by a vast majority. So following the steps of Argentina and 8 Brazilian states. So good news on gay rights.
And how do you think that's being received in Brazil? But also in Uruguay. I mean, it's so interesting that the Pope is Argentinian these days, and you you know, you see that Uruguay is just nestled there next to Argentina, but something of a liberal sort of bastion in that area in many ways.
I would say so. And an interesting note, I was reading a research as well that the Latin American Catholics, they are actually quite liberal comparing to the rest of the population. That might come as a surprise, but I think the most conservative groups we have in Latin America nowadays are the evangelicals, which they are actually rising. For example, in Brazil, they're about 20% of the population now. About 20 years ago, they were only like less than 10%. So they are the ones who are quite conservative.
And another story from El Globo about an exhibition here right in London.
Exactly. I'm happy for that. Then I can go and visit. It's at the Natural History Museum. It's about iconic Brazilian photographer Sebastião Salgado. I don't know if you know his work, but he's possibly one of the most famous photographers, not only Brazil, but all around the world. And his exhibition is called Genesis. And he went to kind of to five different places. He went to Brazil and the Amazon. He went to Africa, Northern Spaces, Planet South, Sanctuaries. The exhibition is divided in five teams, one from each part of the world. And he went to meet some tribes in Africa. Like, can you see this picture?
Fascinating.
From the Mursi village in Ethiopia. And it's quite an interesting picture, you know, that's...
Shows two women in traditional, I guess, indigenous garb, and they're both wearing these amazing lip plates,
exactly,
which are fascinating. It's a beautiful picture, isn't it?
And I have to say, Sebastião Salgado, even though he's iconic and good, there's a lot of critics saying that he plays some kind of the poverty porn somehow, you know? But, and, yeah.
Well, thanks very much, Fernando, for that. A check of today's Brazilian front pages. Unfortunately, though, that's all the time we have for today. Thanks to our producer, Marcus Hippie, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and Barbara Feeney. Our studio manager was Chris Fitch. Up after the news is The Culture Show, hosted by Robert Bound. And at midday London time, the briefing comes live from Madrid from Think Shower Conference. Monocle's editor, Andrew Tuck, and our Madrid correspondent, Liam Aldis, will be interviewing leaders in Spain's cultural, political, tech, sport, and media scenes.
Phil and Tom Edwards will be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But for now, thanks for listening.
Bye-bye. Goodbye.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.